The Ringer MLB Show is brought to you by SeatGeek, the best app for buying and selling tickets to sporting events, concerts, and more. For $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase on any game or sporting event, use promo code RINGERMLB. Download the SeatGeek app or go right to SeatGeek.com.
Hello and welcome to the Ringer MLB Show. My name is Michael Bauman. I'm a staff writer at the Ringer. On today's Ringer MLB Show, we've got Zach Cram on the holy trinity of Manny Machado, Bryce Harper, and Mike Trout dominating baseball once again. Roger Sherman has some takes about the playoff implications of being no hit. And Ben Lindbergh jumps on to talk about the Astros, the Red Sox, and the strike zone being made out of lava. My name is Michael Bauman. I'm a staff writer at the Ringer. This, like every episode of the Ringer MLB Show, is brought to you by the Ringer Podcast Network, where right now we are overflowing with NBA playoff content, Heat Check, Draft Class, numerous other episodes on the Ringer NBA channel all throughout the NBA playoffs. And if you like the spoken word, we have written content for you as well. Just in terms of baseball, we've got Ben Lindbergh on the evolution of pounding the strike zone. We're going to talk about that article later on the show today. Also on the site right now is a piece of mine titled The Disgrace of Minor League Baseball. That compares the plight of the American minor league baseball player to minor leaguers and other North American sports. So please check out both of those as well as the rest of the content on theringer.com and the Ringer Podcast Network. Now we can start the show. Leading off, Fred McGriff, the Cram Dog, Zach Cram, Ringer writer, podcast favorite. How you doing?
Hello.
So if you look at the Major League home run leaderboards right now, you'll get some familiar names, some guys that we've been tracking since they were teenage prospects, teenage big leaguers in a lot of these cases. I, of course, am talking about Mitch Haniger and Charlie Blackmon, as well as Mike Trout, Manny Machado, and Bryce Harper. And it just, like, it feels right to have those guys at the top of the leaderboard because of all the hype around them when they were coming up. The trio, the blessed trinity of top prospects from like the 2011-2012 range. So let's start talking about that. Like, you know, this does feel like these guys are supposed to be the best players in baseball. And there have been, they've all sort of gone through different periods of adversity that have prevented them from lining up like this.
Yeah. And I also think it's kind of cool because all of these players, as three of the top five players in baseball, maybe contribute in so many other ways, whether it's on defense or base running or walking all the time. So it's actually kind of surprising to see all of them at the top of the home run leaderboard, even though we all knew that they had this potential in them. To see all of them together like this, maybe it won't hold up, but you're right. It's kind of fitting. It just feels right, even this early in the season, to have the stars, no pun intended, line up like this.
Yeah, like Trout had two stolen bases last night. I thought that like he had sort of taken his Vince Coleman years and left them behind in his early 20s, but he'll still take a base if you leave it open for him.
Yeah, and Trout, you mentioned the five names of Haniger, Blackmon, and then these three, but Haniger, Blackmon, Harper, and Machado all have 8 home runs, and Trout has 9, which, again, it's early, but he leads the majors. And if you look at his baseball reference page, he has in the past led in runs, RBI, stolen bases, on base percentage, slugging. So he even led the AL in strikeouts 1 year. He's almost like trying to check off leading the league in every single category at least once. He hasn't done it in homers yet, but right now he's on pace for 50, 60 home runs, which is kind of remarkable. And even though any on pace numbers at this point are bound to be misleading or they'll fall short in a month or two when his pace slows down, if anyone in baseball is capable of getting 60 home runs, I think you have to expect it'd be Trout.
What I'd say about on pace numbers is they are useful for like illustrative purposes, but there's a level of seriousness. Like this guy's on pace for, you know, we don't think Haniger's going to hit 50 home runs or whatever he's on pace for, but like you look at Trout, you smell at that like 54 home run range, you think, yeah, it's possible.
Bryce Harper, same thing. Harper, if anyone in the majors over the last 5 years has caused us to question whether Trout is the best player in baseball, it'd be Harper in 2015 when he won the MVP. He basically led the league in every offensive category he could, and he hit 42 homers that year. And that was for the most part, before the ball started traveling further. He is almost what he's doing this year is almost more impressive because he's walking so much that just gives him fewer opportunities to homer. His walk rate right now is 28%. So even if that regresses somewhat, he could conceivably finish with a 25% walk rate. And here's every previous person who's done that is Ted Williams once, and then Barry Bonds in 2001, 2002, 2003, and 2004. So Harper is basically walking at early aughts Bonds levels, but he's also homering almost at early aughts Bonds levels too, which in this day and age of yes, the home run rates are up, but also strikeout rates are up, and it's just harder to hit that many home runs when you have fewer opportunities to put the ball in play. I think what he's doing is perhaps the most impressive of anyone in the group.
Yeah, and I was going to, like, the walk rate has always been something that set him apart, and he's done this sort of early season thing. I mean, there was that period, it was last year where he got intentionally walked like three or four times in a game against the Cubs. And part of that is, you know, part of walk rate is fear factor. It's not just having a good batting eye, but he has that ability, particularly as strikeout rates, like Aaron Judge is one of a billion roughly home run hitters where you live with the bad strikeouts to get to the power and, you know, the high batting average and the high OBP. And like, that's not necessarily a criticism. You know, Babe Ruth was the same way, but there's a special level of like baseball nerd reverence for guys who walk a lot, who hit a lot of home runs, but didn't strike out a lot. And Harper is sort of in that vein. Pujols was like that all the way back to Joe DiMaggio. And that's, I mean, you know, you think about, you know, Trout is his ratios have never been what set him apart, really. And, you know, Manny Machado was never a big walker coming up. But Harper really always had this tool in his locker, and the other guys haven't really.
Harper also, speaking of what sets him apart, has probably the most stupefying highlight of the year so far with that home run off Jacob DeGrom where the bat broke at the handle and he was left holding what looked like a candle in his hands and there was nothing else. It was strange, and I still don't quite know how that happened or how many players in the majors could possibly perform that feat, but it's going to be hard to top that in terms of a home run highlight this year, unless a guy hits the ball like 550 feet.
So let's go to the guy who was sort of number three on this. You know, Trout and Harper were number one and two, or one, two, or one and three on all those prospect lists. You know, big ups to Matt Moore, who broke into that top two for a while. But Machado was always sort of a level below them in terms of the public imagination. But there was always a fascination with him because Harper and Trout were outfielders and Machado was a shortstop coming up. And he did a lot of the little things that baseball guys loved, where I think there was a time where he might have been a little bit overrated as a prospect as sort of a rebuttal to Trout and Harper. But right now he's a top 10 player in baseball, I think. And that's not particularly controversial no matter who you are, but he's putting up the offensive goods right now after a season that was sort of disappointing in parts last year.
Yeah, I think what separates Trout and even Harper, what separates Trout from Harper and Machado isn't ceiling necessarily. Harper proved that in 2015, but it's Trout's floor which separates him from the other two and from everyone else in baseball, because Trout in all of his full seasons has been a top five player in baseball at the worst. But Harper in 2016... he had a worse batting line than Melky Cabrera, and Machado last year was only a league average hitter. His WRC plus was 102 when league average is 100. So for basically a full season, Machado was still a good player. His defensive ability gives him that high a floor to begin with, but to ascend to MVP levels, I don't think Machado has really put together a full offensive season like that yet. Even at his peak offensive levels, he either wasn't walking enough or wasn't hitting for enough power. He hasn't had that season yet where it all comes together. And I guess this might lead into the next part of our conversation, but for him to do it in potentially his last year in a Baltimore uniform right before he and Harper are free agents is pretty remarkable and could lead to an even more fascinating winter than we already expected.
And that's, yeah. And I didn't want to turn this right to where will Machado and Harper be playing next year? But it's such a good point, because I think of those two guys as guys who are in their mid-20s at their prime with a strong track record. You don't like the reason A-Rod got the biggest contract in baseball history when he hit free agency for the first time was not only that he was the best player in the game or one of the best players in the game. It's because he was still young enough. The teams were still buying up his prime years. And the last guy I thought that about, like I said, when he hit free agency, it would be impossible to overpay him, is Jason Hayward. And he's another guy who showed offensive flashes, but whose glove was really his best tool. And he was a good offensive player throughout the end of his time with the Cardinals, but he wasn't a Harper level hitter. And up until, Machado, like you said, has never proved that he was that level of an offensive player for an entire season. And like the difference in what Machado might get paid if he keeps this up for a full year is like, it could be the difference between, oh boy, we're worried about another Jason Hayward, and oh, this could be Harper, but adding up the middle defensive position.
Yeah, I think the age point is a really giant part of it. Machado and Harper are both going to hit free agency at 26 years old, and Aaron Judge was a rookie last year and he turns 26 later this week. So that just speaks to how much of their prime they still have left. So, if you're giving them a 10-year contract, part of that 10 years is their age 26, 27, and 28 seasons, as opposed to their age 36, 37, and 38 seasons. I think Machado also has an interesting wrinkle, which is that he moved back to shortstop this year. He was, depending on how you feel about Nolan Arenado, either the best or second best defensive third baseman over the last half decade. Now at shortstop, he's maybe an average shortstop. It's really too early for the defensive numbers to mean anything, but they aren't really great for Machado thus far. That might be illuminating to what he's going to sign up for at his future. If he goes to, Philadelphia, J.P. Crawford and Scott Kingery might be better defensive shortstops at this point. But the Machado-Harper debate is probably going to sustain us for the whole rest of the year, whether it's which team is are the Yankees or Dodgers going to go after they reset the luxury tax, or which is more valuable, what position is the consistency versus ceiling argument. As you are sort of a Phillies guy, do you have a preference at this point if that team could only sign one of them this offseason, who you would pick?
I'd probably rather have Harper. First of all, I just think he's a better player, and I think the bat is a little safer. I mean, ask me again in 3 months, and I might be sucked in by Machado. I think the shortstop thing is important, though, because if where he wants to go is contingent on him playing shortstop, like I think, he is. I think he's the best defensive third baseman in baseball when he plays there. And no disrespect to Matt Chapman or Nolan Arenado, who are also incredible, but I think his skills play up at third in a way that is unique to, unique to his quickness off the ball and his throwing arm. And you take him to shortstop, and like you said, he becomes a pretty good defender. And the Phillies, J.P. Crawford, I don't think there's a question about it. J.P. Crawford's a better defensive shortstop than Machado, whereas Machado could be an incredible defensive third baseman if he wants to play there. And I think it's a question not just of does the positional adjustment make up for whatever, the guy that Machado's replacing at short versus third base, or it's not a war question. I think it's also an is Machado happy question, and I'd be willing to sacrifice a couple runs of defensive value, however you measure that, to make sure that he's enjoying himself, that he's that he's looking forward to coming to the park every day. And if playing shortstop makes that much of a difference, then I don't think he's going to sign in Philadelphia. I mean, there is I've been beating that drum a lot, mostly just to fuck with Mallory. But I think this is an interesting thing, not just for the Phillies or the Yankees or the Dodgers, or there are half a dozen teams who feel like where a lot of fans like feel like it's a sure thing that this guy is going to come as a free agent. And Phillies fans sure as hell think that about Mike Trout when he comes, or when he hits free agency in another year or in, was it two more years after this, right? But it's just fascinating to see. There are just so many teams whose fans think that for sure that they're going to get Harper or Machado or Trout in a couple years. And they can only go one place each. So it'll be interesting to see who gets disappointed and how they react to that.
And I think that's fun after an offseason where a lot of the discourse was negative for fair reasons. I think next offseason, if Machado and Harper continue to play this well, will just be more fun. Clayton Kershaw could join them as an opt-out. Josh Donaldson will be a free agent. So I think there's a lot of options and there will be a lot of excitement. And it's just more fun that way. You know, we as baseball nerds, we love our Mitch Hanigers and our Matt Chapmans, but it's also fun from a broader, for the good of the sport perspective, if the best players, talent-wise, are also the best and most well-known players in a given season, that's more fun. It'll be more fun if Mike Trout returns to the playoffs, if the Nationals can right the ship and try to finally win a series with Bryce Harper in town. It's just more entertaining for the game at large, and I think it's welcoming for the sport for even in April, all the best players to be playing at their best. I mean, Machado and Harper are both setting career best right now in walk and strikeout rate. They're just completely in control at the moment. And it's cool to see that this holy trinity that you discuss really all play to their highest potential.
Let me leave you with one last question. Harper, like you said, the Nationals haven't won a playoff series with him and Rendon and Strasburg and now Max Scherzer, really recalls like 1990s Mariners levels of turning so much talent, so much charismatic talent into very little postseason results. But Trout, the Angels haven't won a playoff game with Trout on the roster or Albert Pujols. And so now they've got Ohtani. Now they're putting up a legitimate challenge to the Astros, who, in my mind, are probably the best team in baseball right now. Who's got more pressure, do you think, to make it to the postseason and actually follow through? Because is it Harper and the Nationals just because it's probably his last year, or is it Trout because the Angels now have Ohtani and because they've accomplished even less than Washington has?
Well, I think it's interesting. First, both teams could conceivably make the wild card game this year. And if the Nationals win the wild card round, will they count that as winning a playoff series? But I think Washington...
You'll take what you can get at that point, right?
I think Washington probably has slightly more pressure for a few reasons. One, Harper's leaving after this year. Trout is not. Ohtani is also going to be in Los Angeles for the next five seasons. And two, I think with Washington, you also get the entire region's playoff failures. It's been so long since any team in Washington made the Final Four. We're preparing for the annual Capitals collapse in the NHL playoffs. The Wizards are once again tantalizing with their potential and will probably lose in a painful seven-game series. So I think it's an entire regional thing as opposed to just one specific team, and you have a closer deadline. So Washington probably has more pressure. They also entered the season with higher expectations, but I talk about for the good of the sport, it was great for Jose Altuve to break out on a national stage last year. Trout should hopefully be the next man up.
All right. Well, we'll come back next week to talk about more baseball topics, as well as your lack of faith in Alexander Ovechkin. I can't believe that you don't think they're going to get past the Penguins this time. Zach Cram is a writer at theringer.com. You can find his work there. And thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a quick break and be back with Roger Sherman and his wild ass theories about no hitters. Want an unfair advantage to dominate your fantasy baseball league? Well, look no further and download SquadQL for free for your Apple and Android devices. SquadQL is the only mobile app you need to crush your friends and rivals this year. It recommends the best starting lineup each day based on your starters, bench players, and free agent pool. How does SquadQL actually do this? The app connects directly with your Yahoo, ESPN, and CBS leagues, pulling in your actual roster and your league scoring system. It also provides waiver wire recommendations, daily updates to player rankings, and much more. Head to the Apple app and Google Play stores to download SquadQL, your all-in-one fantasy baseball manager. SquadQL is brought to you by the creators of RotoQL, the leading daily fantasy lineup optimizer trusted by over 100,000 DFS players. You can also download RotoQL for free for both Apple and Android. Here at the Ringer MLB Show, topics come to us in a variety of fashions. Last weekend, there were numerous attempts at no-hitters, near misses, Bartolo Colon, Tyson Ross on Friday, and then on Saturday, Sean Manaea finally pulled it off. And when Manaea finished his no-hitter, into Slack comes Roger Sherman with the following. "Look, I'm drunk, but I have a take. If you get no hit, you shouldn't be allowed to win the World Series. Auto disqualifier. The last three outs of no hitters are already a top tier sports thing, but imagine if getting no hit literally ended the other team's chance of winning a championship on the spot. I'm going to go drink some more, but workshop this for me, please." So here, having workshopped this and refined the take, is the man himself, Roger Sherman. How you doing?
I'm great. I'm not drunk right now. Good. Do I need to go start drinking heavily, or is it better that I'm sober for this?
I think we should just go ahead. I don't know if we've got time for you to go hit the bar.
It might take a few minutes.
So explain why. I found myself intrigued by this, but not really understanding why.
So the main reason for it at the time is that my preferred baseball team is the New York Yankees. And I just realized that the Boston Red Sox, who seem very good this year, got no hit. And the Red Sox being good is, of course, an existential threat to the Yankees. So I was like, really, how could any team that goes an entire game without recording a single hit be considered in any way part of contention? How can any team that completely fails to do its job for nine innings, with not even a slight amount of success, they shouldn't be in the running to win the championship? But I thought about it more, and what appeals to me about this very bad idea that I have is that my favorite thing to watch in baseball is any game with high stakes. Any game seven, it's thrilling to me. I love the feel of the last few innings of a tight baseball game. I just... With all the other sports I write about, with all the other things I pay attention to, I can't get into the flow of an entire baseball season. There are 162 games. That's so many. And I think that this could transform any individual game, even if it's between two teams out of the running, even if it's the, ninth inning and one team's up, 11-0, it could transform any individual moment into one of the greatest sports events of a year. If at any point a team that, is sort of in contention can just, by failing on one day, can get knocked out entirely, that makes that an amazing moment, something that we would cherish, something that would go down in history. Do you remember when X team was up like seven games in like August and then they got no hit by the Marlins, and then their season was over? That'd be beautiful.
So the no hitters, you think about no hitters being more common in this, the day of more strikeouts, more walks and so forth. But this was the first no hitter in almost a year. We've been getting about one a year, except for 2015 when we had, I'm just counting here, we had seven. And I'll get back to 2015 in a minute. How do you think the game would change if, for some reason, we adopted this rule? Obviously, like, there would be a premium on contact hitters, I imagine.
Yeah. And, recently there's been a trend where something which probably would have been unspeakable in past decades, but where a guy has a no hitter, but we try to preserve pitchers these days. So, if their pitch count's getting a little high, we take them out. Under the stipulations of this rule, a combined no-hitter wouldn't count. It would have to be a one-person no-hitter.
Okay.
So we'd be ruining players' arms for the sake of this one brilliant day, if it ever comes along. I think we'd see, teams would try to bunt to break it up, which has been long an unwritten rule. But if your season's on the line, you just got to throw the unwritten rules out of the book. We'd see pitchers staying in the game longer. And, you know, there are some games late in the season where you want to rest players, give them a day off. You know, if your season's on the line, all those players are getting pinch hit back into the lineup, and it'll make more interesting situations in those rare, beautiful instances where a pitcher has a no-hitter going.
So let me give you the 2015 season. In 2015, there were 7 no-hitters thrown.
Yes, and not against bad teams either.
Okay, so you already know where this is going. Out of the 5 National League playoff teams that year, 4 of them got no-hit. The Mets and Dodgers got no-hit twice. So, like, this has got to be Armageddon for you.
Yeah, and it would be beautiful. It'd be beautiful because you have all these teams that should be in the running, and all of a sudden the season just gets reinvigorated because all these teams that are, you know, however many games back, get punched right into the running again because it's, you know, August and the Dodgers just got no hit, and it revitalizes the end of those dog days.
So the San Francisco Giants, Chris Heston, threw a no hitter against the New York Mets, and then the Dodgers got no hit twice. Chris Heston's no hitter might have inadvertently put the Giants back in the playoff race that year. That would have been, yeah. I mean, this is ridiculous. It's random, but it would be a lot of fun. How much do you think this would increase the value of somebody like Max Scherzer, like a pitcher who's, it seems like 10 times a year he goes out there with no hit stuff and either actually throws a no hitter or strikes out 16 guys and gives up one hit. You know, how would he become the most, would this kind of pitcher become the most valuable player in the league?
Yeah, if you could go deep into a game, you not only have a chance to, you know, that's not only a useful baseball trait most of the time, but all of a sudden, if you're on a second or third place team, you have a guy who can literally knock other teams out of the playoffs in one game. If you have, you know, Jake Arrieta, who also has a couple no-hitters in the past few years, you know, guys like that who could just throw all day. I assume that anyone who is actually a huge baseball purist has either tuned out or started writing me death letters at this point. Mm-hmm. Because it goes against everything about the nature of a baseball season where, you know, it's supposed to be this beautiful marathon where things ebb and flow day by day. And I'm like, no, I want there to be like huge knockout situations all throughout the season.
That sort of quotidian low level interest is sort of the lazy summer appeal of baseball, but baseball is at its best in the postseason where anything can happen on any pitch and it can end the season. I do see the appeal of like, of sort of transporting that to any single game. I don't know if it's going to be good for the national public health to put that kind of anxiety like every time. Like Gerrit Cole had a perfect game through 4 innings and change last night. I'm thinking, oh my God, what does this mean? You know, could Trout and Ohtani get knocked out of the playoffs by the end of April? Like, I don't know if that's good for everybody, but it might make things more interesting.
Well, then it will reinstill that quotidian love of baseball in the fans of like the Yankees when they get no hit in May and then have just an entire season worth absolutely nothing.
God, that would suck.
That's the other flip side. Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of the season is already worth nothing to so many teams, but so my one catch is, and this is a catch, but it could also be a real moment for innovation, is if this were a rule, we would have to have a serious talk about what an error is and really, really redefine how errors are legislated, who's in charge of saying what's an error and what is it, because otherwise you'd have an official scorer in charge of being like, yeah, I think that guy could have made a play on the ball. So turns out the Giants season's over.
I was going to say, like, you'd need official scorers to have their identities obscured. Like, you know, how like British special forces, whenever they go on TV, they always have their faces pixelated and stuff. Like, you need to put these guys in witness protection at the very least.
You'd have to have
I mean, that's
official like review system that a lot of other sports have with like a centralized league office, except just for errors and no hitters.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't seem exactly practical to me, but this idea already isn't very practical. So I'm here for extending the impracticality of it.
Well, let me leave you with this. So you said that this was originally just a purely partisan thing. You want to get the Red Sox out of the way. The Yankees, starting next week, have a 10-game stretch where they play 4 against the Astros, 3 against Cleveland, 3 against the Red Sox, which those might be the 3 best rotations in baseball right now. Have I gotten you at the exact 1 week spot where you think this is a good idea? Are you willing to take your chances for those 10 games?
I mean, the Yankees haven't been no hit since 1958. In it by one person. So I am going to say that it's not going to happen again soon, and then it will, and then I will be hoisted, and it will be I will regret having this belief. But yeah, no, I haven't looked at that schedule. The thing is, I just like to think that if my baseball team is worth anything, they would find a way somewhere in those 7th, 8th, 9th innings to make something, just to get one hit. If your entire season, if your entire year depended on it, you know, baseball is this game where, you know, these weird instances happen, and I want to heighten the importance of those weird instances with my terrible idea.
That sounds like typical Yankee fan hubris to me. If the Yankees do get no hit over the next 10 games and wind up missing the playoffs as a result, you can find Roger Sherman and complain to him on Twitter at @Roger_Sherman. He writes about, I was going to say, a lot of college sports, but a little bit of everything at theringer.com. And I thank you for sharing this little bit of your soul with me today.
Hey, thanks for having me. And I don't actually think they should go through with this.
Okay. All right. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Thanks.
Now, let's call on our closer, Ben Lindbergh. It's Ben Lindbergh, the closer. This is closer's music. Ben!
Hello, how are you?
I am jazz. Guess what I'm doing tonight?
What are you doing? Going to a ball game in Houston, perhaps? Seeing Shohei Ohtani?
Exactly what I'm doing. In fact, by the time most people have listened to this segment, I will be neck deep in Shohei Ohtani. So I was really excited to see Garrett Cole last night, but I mean, this is the event.
I can't say I'm not envious. Just tell him about me. I'm sorry that you're getting to see him before I am.
Well, we're not allowed to talk to him. So I guess like I'll try to slip a note to Martin Maldonado in the clubhouse. Right.
He'll pass it in one of the 6-man visits.
Do you love Ben? Check yes or no. So Shohei Ohtani is pitching with first place on the line tonight because the Angels have sort of drifted back towards the pack and the Houston Astros have come charging forward like a Soviet nuclear-powered icebreaker through the through Chicago and Seattle over the past week or so. There's a half game separating the two. But today we wanted to talk about the Astros versus the Boston Red Sox because this has been a story going through the first couple weeks of the season where we had 6 obvious division favorites and all of them have really faltered in one way or another, except for these two teams. So let's, I guess, start with the pitching, right? They're way off the front. They're both a win ahead of everybody else in Fangraphs WAR for whatever that's worth in the third week of April, but they're first and third in ERA minus, first and seventh in strikeout percentage. They've had incredible individual performances. So I guess let's just start there. That seems like an obvious place to go.
Yeah, I mean, when you suggested that we talk about this, I thought it would be an easier call. I thought I would be finding edges for the Astros, and I thought that maybe pitching would be the most obvious place, and the rotation certainly, just because it's been so great top to bottom. But even if you just limit it to the rotation alone, the Red Sox really stack up pretty close to the Astros so far. Of course, you have to distinguish between what they have done and what they've been and what they actually are and what they actually will be for the rest of the season. And I think I would still give the Astros rotation the edge here. I think the bullpens are pretty close, really. I don't know that the Astros bullpen is as dominant maybe as the rest of their team looks, but I guess I would give the edge to the Astros in the rotation here, but it's pretty close. I feel like by the time October rolls around, there will be more good Astros starters standing that I would be afraid of facing in a short series than will be the case for the Red Sox.
I actually think it depends. I think there are a couple guys, Morton and Cole in particular. I mean, I was going to say pitching over their heads. Justin Verlander's not going to have a 110 ERA all season. If he does, then we'll come back to that when, you know, in June or July, if he's still doing that. But I think 1 through 5, you just look at Sale, Price, Pomerantz, Porcello versus Keuchel, Verlander, Cole, and I guess you'd call Charlie Morton the fourth starter right now. I think I'd take that group. Like, if those are the four guys you're throwing into a playoff rotation, I think I'd take Boston's over over Houston's. The thing is, Houston has so much more depth. Like, it's not so deep in, you know, you don't have to go so deep into Boston's stable of starting pitchers before you're getting into Brian Johnson. Whereas the Astros, like, they've just got Colin McHugh and Brad Peacock, who were both very good big league starting pitchers in the past year or two.
Half the Astros bullpen, they could just move right into the rotation and you'd hardly have a drop off. So
they've got two or three middle relievers who are just killing time, like just waiting for somebody to get hurt.
Well, we've seen how great Cole has been. I know that you are talking to him and working on something related to him. He has been fantastic. And we saw how great Morton was in the postseason last year. Looks like he's been even better so far this year. He's throwing harder somehow, and he was already throwing a lot harder than he had been before. And no, Verlander won't end up with a 1-something ERA, but we know that Verlander is really good. I guess if you have to do the battle of the aces, I'd take Sale over Verlander, but I would want either of those guys. So both of these rotations maybe have a guy or two who you worry about being an injury risk, whether it's McCullers in the Astros case or maybe David Price in the Red Sox case, who, you know, he's had the elbow issues in the past. But you're right. I think coupled with the depth issue that you mentioned, I'm still taking the Astros squad here, but it's a much closer call than I would have said it was 3 weeks ago.
Just to touch again briefly on Cole before we move on to the lineups sort of, and then that comparison, he was throwing through guys last night. It was just the fastball. Like, Garrett Cole's had a big fastball ever since we've known who Garrett Cole was, and just the ability to miss bats with a four seamer that doesn't really look like it's moving that much, just getting guys who just can't catch up to it. I didn't think starting pitchers could do that anymore. So if this is more than just a hot couple of weeks, we could have to reevaluate, you know, what we think about Garrett Cole. Like, he might be the best, if he pitches like this, he might be the best pitcher on the staff, but we're 3.5 weeks into the season. So he looks great now. We'll see how he looks in May or June or July. So the Astros lineup was, by OPS plus, maybe literally the best offense in baseball history.
Yes.
Last year, and they brought almost everybody back, and it's been kind of disappointing.
Yeah, that's kind of the one area, I guess, where the Red Sox have a clear edge so far, and I don't know that it will be as big going forward. I think the Red Sox lineup was a surprising disappointment last season, and they had a power outage, and just all of their regulars went backwards for one reason or another, and they've all bounced back to some extent this year. Of course, they added JD Martinez too, whereas the Astros sort of stood pat. So given that, Bogart seems to have bounced back, although he is hurt right now, but not for long. Betts is great, and I think he was kind of unlucky last year and now isn't anymore. It's really hard to pick against the team that, as you said, had one of the best offenses ever last year and is essentially the same now, minus Carlos Beltran, who wasn't contributing to that offense much last year anyway. But I kind of like the Red Sox right now. If I had to give an edge here, and it's very slight either way, but I might go with the Red Sox. And, you know, they may have Dustin Pedroia back in the second half. Who knows what he'll be like, but he is, you know, getting into baseball action again after his knee surgery. So it's close, but if I'm giving the toss up to the Astros in pitching and rotation, I think I might give it to Boston here.
Yeah, I think right now you have to favor the Astros offense over Houston's. Where I think you and I might disagree is going forward. You know, you look at both of these two teams. Let's, you know, if we're calling the pitching staff sort of a wash, I think they're close. I mean, they're pretty close in record. And the Red Sox, I think, sort of are what you would hope they would be right now, up and down the lineup. I mean, obviously, they're going to get Bogarts back, like you said. And then Eduardo Nunez is sort of that back into that super sub role where he's mm-hmm. really well qualified to just plug in wherever. And after that, Mitch Moreland's got an OPS over 1,000 right now. I'm going to take the under on that going from now until the rest of the season. I don't think anybody else is really going to crater, but mm-hmm. I think this is just what you would hope the Red Sox would do. Whereas Houston, Reddick's hitting well. Springer's doing well. Okay. Yeah, McCann's hitting really well. Altuve and Correa are hitting like Altuve and Correa. And there are a couple guys mm-hmm. that are just sort of waiting to get going. They've gotten nothing from Derek Fisher, which I don't know what the expectation really was for Derek Fisher coming into the season. Mm-hmm. Jake Marisnyk and Marwin Gonzalez were probably had the best offensive seasons of their careers last year, but this year
I didn't expect either of those things to continue, but yes, Marisnyk has an OPS plus of zero right now.
Zero. So,
yes.
30 and in 56 plate appearances, 30 strikeouts, zero walks, which I'm almost wondering if somebody dropped a cell in the data scraping on Baseball Reference that this is it looks like Marisnyk's offensive line right now looks like a typo, and he was never a great hitter before, but he was better.
That's
than
like
this.
Eye exam territory. That's like you need LASIK possibly. I think those are kind of peripheral contributors, though. And I expected Marwin to take a big step back. I think he was maybe one of the luckiest and flukiest hitters last year, although he was very valuable. So I don't see that much potential here to be better. I mean, I think that some guys will be better, but other guys, whether it's Reddick and McCann, those guys will be worse too. I mean, it's possible that the Astros lineup will outscore the Red Sox lineup or be better after you park adjust from today forward, but it's not that big a gap, really. It's very small, and these are both very good offensive teams.
All right, so who you got?
I'm going to stick with the Astros. I think, part of it is just remembering what we thought 3 weeks ago, which is that the Astros could be an all-time great team. And they've played essentially how we thought they would play. It's not like they've underperformed. The fact that we're even having this discussion is a product of the fact that the Red Sox have been much better than expected. I mean, the Astros are on, 108 win pace or something right now. So that's basically what we thought or hoped they would be. And I just have to stick
somewhat
with my...
I'm really glad you did that math in your head.
We have to just stick somewhat to preseason expectations. I think just historically speaking, we know that the preseason projections tell us more about what a team will be going forward than the in-season record, even once you get to June, and we're not even to May yet. So I'm sticking with the Astros, but I think that even though the Astros will outplay the Red Sox from today forward, I think that they'll end up roughly around the same place record-wise, just because the Red Sox are off to such a phenomenal start that you can bake mm-hmm. in some regression and still get them to 100 wins or more pretty easily.
When you and Zach and I have talked about changing the outlook for a team, when the Mets went off to their hot start early this mm-hmm. season, obviously, the Red Sox have banked enough wins. We talk about they're five games up on the Yankees right now, and that might change who you think about being the favorite in the American League East. But mm-hmm. have they played well enough to change your opinion of the team?
I think so.
Is that even possible in 3 weeks?
I think so. Well, in the sense that I picked the Yankees to win the division, although I thought it was close, and now I would no longer do that. That is partially a product of those banked wins. But I think the Red Sox, I think of them as a better team today than I did a few weeks ago. Maybe that is recency bias to some extent, but I think they are better, but they just haven't caught up to the Astros yet. I think the Astros are probably a better defensive team. I don't know that either one is the equal of, say, the Angels, for instance, but I think the Astros probably get an edge on the defensive side, which maybe helps if you think the Red Sox have better pitching. Maybe the defense evens it out. I think the Astros are probably superior pitching-wise anyway. So going with the Astros, but it's going to end up being a lot closer than I would have forecasted.
All right, so we talked about
these two teams starting rotations. And, you know, guys like Gerrit Cole, thrown more strikes now than he has in years. But you wrote about on Friday a group of pitchers, including Houston's Lance McCullers, who have abandoned the strike zone. So this is one of those trend pieces that we could start talking about right now. So why don't you give a quick summary of what you found?
Yeah, well, you and I talked to Tom Verducci on an episode of this podcast last year about how some teams, including the Astros and the Yankees, are prioritizing breaking balls to a greater extent. That old mindset about how you have to establish the fastball and everything works off the fastball. I think more and more teams are realizing if you have a really good breaking ball, you can ride that thing a lot harder than in the past pitchers would have been encouraged to. And so we're seeing a higher percentage than ever of breaking balls relative to harder pitches. Lots of teams throwing more sliders, more curveballs. And so the net effect of that, as well as maybe pitchers just avoiding the strike zone because of all the home runs we've seen in recent years, is that there are just more pitches outside of the strike zone now than ever before, or at least ever on record. And so that's working for a lot of pitchers, I think, because their stuff is good and hitters are chasing, but it has some side products and unintended consequences that I think maybe are hurting baseball a bit from a spectator perspective. Walks are way up. Strikeouts, of course, again, are way up. Hit by pitches are way up. In fact, we haven't seen this many hit by pitches since baseball's prehistoric era, basically the pre-modern era, like 1900 and earlier. And that's potentially dangerous, as we saw with Chris Bryant getting hit in the face this past weekend. More hit by pitches equals more risk, more danger. But it also means just fewer balls in play, longer waits for each decisive pitch. And that's something that I think you and I have disagreed a bit about in the past, about just how great an existential threat it is to the sport. But if you thought that baseball was slow or not enough balls in play before, it is just getting more and more extreme every season. And this season seems to be maybe accelerating those trends.
Yeah. And as one of those people, like you said, is a little more prone to panic about stuff like this, all I've been thinking about for the past 2 years or so is something Joe Sheehan said on, this was an old Will Leach podcast a couple years ago, that soon strikeouts will be more common than hits.
Yes, and we're there.
As of, Joe Sheehan's back on Twitter now saying, here it is, the end. The end is at hand. So, you think about big realigning statistics, not to get too wonky about this, but big realigning statistical movements where you talk about the nature of the game changing, the live ball era, the mound being raised and lowered in the 60s. This might be another one of those. And because we're one thing about post Moneyball baseball is that the rate at which we're learning about baseball has just skyrocketed. And so there's a new evolution that might have taken decades before. One of those is coming every 2.5 years now.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's very difficult to sort of adjust your mental rubric for what baseball ought to look like.
Yeah, and I think there are steps that baseball could take if they decide to address this. You can always make the strike zone smaller or institute some rule about reliever usage. You can counteract these trends, I think, but we've seen enough now that I think we can say that if left unchecked, we're just going to see more and more extreme three true outcome or at least two true outcome baseball. And a lot of people don't like that a whole lot. So I know that baseball is always in flux. It's always changing. Maybe it's changing more and more rapidly right now. But if the sport doesn't like the way that the game is headed on the field, then I think it is going to take some commissioner or the league or collectively bargained agreement. Someone has to step in and say, we are going to take steps to address these things because I don't think they're going to resolve themselves.
And one last one, I think of myself as sort of a StatCast skeptic, at least in terms of how it's deployed. It's a lot more fun facts than it is actual useful data. And, MLB is sort of marketing it as this, as something probably more scientifically rigorous than it actually is. But, but we see these numbers disseminated, in terms of exit velocity or pitch speed, all these things that are measurables that are wow, this is, new records in balls being thrown or hit harder than ever before that sort of play into this era. And, I think a lot of this gets repeated just because, oh, look at these cool numbers. I don't know if there's a nefarious plot to sort of hide that baseball is becoming slower and more boring, but I think that's, how how far away is your tinfoil hat right now in terms of that?
I mean, I think that StatCast has a lot of uses and it can be very valuable. I think that there are just more stats than ever available, and there are more people than ever paying attention to those stats and producing content with those stats. And so there's probably greater potential for those stats to be misused or oversighted as well. So I think there's definitely some fatigue with exit velocity and launch angle. And, you know, when you hear that so-and-so hit the hardest ball in the StatCast era, you have to remind yourself that the StatCast era is, you know, 2015 to present. So it doesn't mean that much, really. But I think there are ways in which just having this data available has probably accentuated some of the trends that we were already seeing, whether it's launch angle, exit velocity. I think teams are paying attention to those, players are paying attention to those. And, you know, if anything, they just encourage the contact averse brand of baseball that we're watching these days.
That's a shame. It's the end of the world. And unfortunately, this is the end of the segment. So yes. I will tell Shohei Ohtani you said hi. I'll figure out a way to do it. And we'll talk to you again next week.
Please do. I will see him in New York next month.
Oh, man. That'll do it for this week's episode of the Ringer MLB Show. Thanks again to Zach Cram, Roger Sherman, and Ben Lindbergh for coming on. Thanks to Sean Manaea, Mike Trout, Bryce Harper, Manny Machado, Garrett Cole, Mookie Betts, and everyone else who provided content for us to discuss today. And thank you for listening. Enjoy this week's games, and we'll be back next week.